The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
What would you do if an uninvited guest locked himself in the bathroom and refused to come out? She writes so well, distinctive, a bit crazy, compelling in the way that language should be, with surprises everywhere. Jeanette Winterson.
Seething with inventiveness, humanity, wit, and language fit for the big rock candy mountain. Sebastian Barry.
A brilliant title for a brilliant novel. She invents new forms of fiction in the interstices between parts of a sentence. A.S. Byatt.
Now, which novel would you think they were talking about? Clue, it's not this year's Booker Prize winner or indeed this year's Orange Prize winner. In fact, it didn't feature on any prize lists at all south of the Scottish border. But it was one of the two most nominated books in the Guardian's Books of the Year special. And we on the Guardian Books podcast team are at one with the great and the good in thinking that Ali Smith's There But For The is one of the novels of the year. Ali's with me here in the studio now as a critic, Alex Clark, who reviewed There But For The for The Guardian back in July, and Patrick Ness, who's one of the celebrity Books of the Year tipsters who singled it out. Ali, we opened this podcast with a blast from Sex Pistols' Anarchy in the UK. Yeah. Can you please explain why?
Oh, with total pleasure. I mean, the book is full of puns, and one of the puns is on the name of the character in the first long section, whose name, her name is actually Anna Hardy, but she's been recast way back in 1980 by a chap she meets for 2 weeks who decides he's going to call her Anna Key in the UK. Because they're not in the UK, they're on their holidays. It's one of those lovely puns from a time where a pun like this, where a pun on anarchy, actually, if we look at it back then and we look at it now, the shift in the ways in which we understand things, even like pop culture, is huge. I mean, I went back when I was writing this novel and I listened to the charts, the British charts, for every week between January and June 1980. Oh my God, the fantastic music, almost all British, almost all immensely political, all about surveillance. You know, there's always someone looking at you, all about the nuclear world, the ways in which, you know, they don't want your name, just your number. Everything that Pop told us was a kind of politics at that point. So it's a light little riff in this book in the first section about the change between, you know, 30 years, the 1980s and now.
Alex, there are a lot of puns in this book.
There's a child who will not stop punning. There are puns in the name Anna Key, Jen and Eric.
The appalling hosts.
Who I felt a sneaking sympathy for. I mean, there's a kind of mystery at the heart of the book, which is that the character who you described that Anna meets for 2 weeks goes to a dinner party, goes to a middle-class dinner party, goes upstairs, people think to go to the bathroom or maybe to get his coat or maybe to leave, locks himself in a room, refuses to come out. And so there's a kind of immediately something making you keep reading and saying, what's going to happen? When's he going to come out? Why is he there? What's he doing? Is this the saddest story ever told, or is it a kind of inverted sort of comedy? The poor hosts who are hosting the most dreadful dinner party in the world, full of the most appalling people, you begin to feel sorry for them. I mean, how would you like it if somebody just turned up and locked themselves in your spare bedroom, in your rather marvellous spare bedroom, as Jen says?
Patrick, you nominated this, as we said at the beginning. What did you find so special about it?
The incredible, enthusiastic use of language. It's a funny story, it's a moving story, and I think it particularly gives the lie to this nonsense of readability versus literary quality, because it's an incredibly readable book. Anyone could get into it, but it is highly, highly literary, but also moving, but also witty, but also funny, and that's kind of a miracle, I think.
Right, I'm going to have to stop you there and say, do you two know each other? Because we always get stick for these books of the years for log rolling. So are you friends secretly and you come in holding hands?
We've met once before.
Several years ago.
So that's giving the lie to the idea that everybody's just back scratching their friends. This is a book that you've discovered and read
as
a reader.
I don't have any friends.
I don't review books by people I know. I don't. If a book is great, I'll recommend it by somebody I know. But this is picked purely because it's a terrific book.
But actually,
and I will happily defend it.
As well, just to put another context on the back scratching, none of us is stupid enough to say, I really love a book, but if it's not a very good book.
Yeah,
I mean, we just wouldn't. I mean, anybody who would be a friend anyway, you would be very straightforward about it. And, if your friends are writers, then it's sometimes a very difficult friendship because you maybe don't get on with what they do.
Alex, can I bring you back on Patrick's point about the language of the book? Because I was fascinated by that, because you don't do the Will Self thing of putting in polysyllabic words that you have to look up in a dictionary at all, do you?
I can do. But this book is really about simple language, and it's about the ways in which the very smallest words work at the very largest and the very smallest levels. So, there, but, for, the four monosyllables, at the end of which there's something, which we imply, which is huge, and is a huge question in the modern world, because it's not there, or is it there, or because we know it, or because we don't know it, and so on. So it's really, really about the workings of language at all of its levels.
And gaps, isn't it? The word that isn't there, or the answer that's not so kind of easy to work out. So one of the jokes that runs through the books is the knock-knock joke, the kind of classic job, who's there? And answering that question is kind of more difficult than any of the characters think it's going to be. So it's sort of about identity, I think. You can kind of put these big words on it, but it is such a kind of simple tale, but disrupted as well. You get lots of different people's stories all melded into one. I think that's something you do kind of a lot in your books, and you've done a lot here. Mm. Suddenly someone is introduced. They seem to be at some tremendous kind of loose end, missing a connection with another character. Where have they come from? Who are they? And it's a kind of slow working out, and the connections between them are very slowly worked out. But not in a way that to me is kind of complex or off-putting.
There are, games with language and explorations of language, but it's in no way exclusionary, which I think perhaps Will Self can be. There's no two fingers up, if you don't know this, come over to me and find it.
Now, A.S. Byatt, who was in the medley that we played at the beginning, said she invents new forms of fiction in the interstices between parts of a sentence. Can you explain that to me, Alex?
Nope.
Yeah, nor I.
I think she's saying, I love what she's saying, which is that I'm finding a fiction for the place where there is no fiction, for the spaces between what we say and what we think we're saying, and also the spaces between what we say and what we're really saying. I mean, in a way, it's a book about space. It's a book about a man who takes a space and then won't let anyone into that space. I mean, we need private space. We need unsaid, unsayable spaces.
What I love about him as a character, this central character, is that he doesn't really want anything, and no one can figure that out. And all the people who eventually mass around him and make him into a sort of cult hero, they need him to want something, and he doesn't. And that's his kind of message, and it sort of seems absolutely unfathomable to everybody else.
Patrick is an award-winning author for teens in his own right, and his latest novel, A Monster Calls, was also nominated as Book of the Year by no less a person than Children's Laureate Julia Donaldson.
A Monster Calls by Patrick Ness and Siobhan Dowd is a novel about a teenager whose mother is dying of cancer. The idea of a yew tree monster telling stories to the boy was conceived by Dowd shortly before her own death. Ness responded to the challenge of writing the book. It's a powerful story, made unforgettable by Jim Kay's inky illustrations.
"I've come to get you, Connor O'Malley," the monster said, pushing against the house, shaking the pictures off Connor's wall, sending books and electronic gadgets and an old stuffed toy rhino tumbling to the floor. A monster, Connor thought. A real, honest-to-goodness monster. In real, waking life, not in a dream, but here, at his window. Come to get him. But Connor didn't run. In fact, he found he wasn't even frightened. All he could feel, all he had felt since the monster revealed itself, was a growing disappointment. Because this wasn't the monster he was expecting. "So come and get me then," he said.
That was the opening of A Monster Calls. You've just finished an award-winning trilogy, Chaos Walking. What made you take on the job of finishing off another author's work?
It was brought to me, and it was suggested to me that maybe I might consider this. And I had just finished three very big books, first person, present tense, all kinds of different challenges. And I was looking to do something in a different style and a different voice just to flex writerly muscles. And this was brought to me, and I normally would just say no, because I don't know that good books are written that way. But she had left just the perfect amount. She had left not so much that I felt confined as to what I had to write, but enough of a potent, small idea that it started suggesting other ideas and where a story might be able to grow and live and thrive. And that's the only way I think a good book could be written.
The monster is a yew tree monster who appears in the night because of other stresses that Connor's going through in his daytime life.
Yes, Connor's mother is ill. She could be very, very ill. And though the word cancer is never said in the book, we can understand that it's cancer. And Siobhan Dowd had selected the monster as a yew tree for a number of reasons, for their ancientness, they live thousands of years, for the connection to English folklore, but also because even currently they can make different kinds of cancer medicine. They do make different kinds of cancer medicines out of yew tree bark. There's a Taxol for breast cancer, there's tamoxifen for ovarian cancer, so it has lots and lots of resonances.
Now, I know that Ali hasn't had a chance to read this book, and she's indeed going away with one in her bag, courtesy of the author. But I want you to look at this, because it is a really beautiful book, and just tell us what your reactions to it are.
Okay, first of all, I think it's the most exciting thing to take the gift of the moment of a story from a writer and then to work on it. In a way, it's what we do all the time, isn't it? It's like because we pick up on stories which exist in their own rights in a way. So, yeah. But the generosity of giving the life to the story of the person who's died is just a kind of golden heart at the centre of this absolutely beautifully made, beautifully illustrated book. And I'm just flicking through the pages here, and it's a mix of dark and light, which is what I presume the story is. I mean, that lovely piece you just read. What a beautiful object it is.
It's got, it looks not unlike Ted Hughes' Iron Man, does it?
That's a good touchstone. Yeah, I really like the feel of Iron Man, and there's actually a really terrific animated film of Iron Man, which is quite brilliant and has some of the themes that I use in the book as well.
Well, that very neatly brings us to our second theme of this podcast, which is beautiful books, as featured in last weekend's edition of Guardian's Saturday Review. Alex, it's been the year of e-books, hasn't it? So why are we suddenly talking about beautiful paper books?
Well, because you've got to have sort of one or the other, haven't you? If you've got so much text available on electronic devices of one kind or another, and so many people turning to ebooks to read, then the things that are left have got to look good, otherwise why would you read them? I'm a kind of fan of ebooks in a way, because I think they actually liberate you just to read text and not be distracted by how many pages there are left, by what the book feels and looks like. But then you miss paper and you under your hand, and you miss pictures, and you miss feeling the kind of quality of what you're holding.
Patrick, this is maybe something that's particularly relevant to children. And I had a very interesting conversation with one of our site members about this. In fact, we've got Luke Shaw on the phone now.
On the question of format, I seem to find, funnily enough, that young people seem to prefer a physical paper copy, whereas it's older people who like the idea of using an electronic device. This is perhaps the opposite of what many people would assume, but I think it's because young people already have very digital lives. We have our mobile phones, our iPods, our laptops, and everything else. So we appreciate reading a book as an escape from this. Whereas for many older people, technology isn't so prominent in their lives, so reading on electronic devices offers a new, interesting and practical way of reading.
I can only speak from my experiences, which is that when I see teenagers at festivals or at schools, when I talk to secondary schools and so on, they queue up with a book in their hand and they want it signed and they want it to be their own personal thing. And I couldn't address the sociological reasons, but that sounds like an interesting one. And though my whole trilogy was about the idea of privacy and the loss of privacy when you're young, because if you think about it, if you're 13, 14, 15, and I say this to them when I talk to them, they have less privacy than anyone has ever had in a Western country, completely, and they hand it over voluntarily in Facebook and networking sites and so on. And as Ali was saying earlier, which I completely agree with, that privacy is so valuable, and it's where you think the unthinkable before you say the unsayable. It's where you decide who you are, and that's so important when you're young, and I try to get them to just draw attention to it, because I mean the world is changing, you have to change with it, but maybe a book, a physical book, is a private thing. Mm-hmm. And I like that idea.
But nevertheless, there are more and more of them coming out, Alex.
I mean, yeah.
Penguin, for example, are doing a whole series of
they're doing a series of kind of short books, and I think next year is kind of slated to be the short e-book, because that's where they do come into their own, and short stories have really come into their own, and this kind of endless agonised upset that the short story is dying out and that it doesn't have a market in physical collections, that people are publishing fewer of them in magazines and in journals, suddenly alive electronically, because what is nicer than to read a short story on a finite train journey, for example?
Mm-hmm. Would you, Ali, read on ebook? Do you have an e-reader?
I don't have an e-reader, but I was thinking about the notion of older people needing liking e-readers more than younger people, and it's something to do with being able to make the text bigger. You know, as we get older, then you know, I know how much it would be nice to be able just to flip a text to another size. I have no problem with e-readers. I think they're just another way to read, you know, and good, because we need as many ways to read as possible. But I just think the book is never going to leave us. We will never lose the book. Look at a book. Pick up a book. It has a spine because animals have a spine. That's why it's called a spine, because that's where the fold of skin, when they made books, fell. You know, so that's it. That's a spine of an animal. It's an organic thing. The pages are made of tree. You know, so the yew tree monster is right the way through this book in actuality. So it's as an organism, as a natural organism, books are never going to leave us. Also, you can't really open a screen, but when you open a book, something opens. There's two sides to something. There's almost a dialogue implied just in two pages. Certainly, there's reflection implied in two pages in both its forms. So we see two things at once, and we also have a thought process because something is opened. I mean, I think the human love affair with the book will never ever leave us. But the more ways we have of reading, yay, the better.
And now we're going to move on to another book, which actually, bringing together both of our two themes we've discussed so far, is called Beautiful Indifference, and it is a short story collection. Here's Sarah Hall talking to Richard Lee.
After four novels, ranging from Cumbria to Italy via post-petroleum totalitarianism and Coney Island, why a set of short stories?
Well, why not? I mean, I've been writing short stories throughout, really, on and off, which I suppose writers do. I think short story writing's possibly a little bit like writing poetry. These things come in cycles, and then you gather up a little knot of short stories and put them aside. So the collection's been on the go for a few years, but the last couple of years I've really been generating more short stories. And I don't know why. I think I've become interested in form and structure more, perhaps, or at least it's become a preoccupation in a way that, or a priority in a way that, perhaps it wasn't for the novel writing, or it's a different exercise, a different discipline. And I've just felt sort of able to generate shorter work somehow.
Do you feel your head's in a different place somehow?
It could be. Yeah, it could be. I mean, I think it's possible that writing something like The Cahill and Army, which was actually written as my fourth novel, because a draft of How to Paint a Dead Man, which was published as my fourth novel, was written third, and I held on to it. But Cahill and Army was the last novel that I actually generated, and that's very interested in kind of plot and structure. And
it's plotted like a thriller, isn't it?
It is. And so from there, I think I've moved into the short stories, you know, which are very much focused on the drama and the plot and the turn and how it all shapes up. So it's possible that Cahillan has just sparked a sort of desire in me to think more in that way.
So it's kind of more structural rather than less. Because I was wondering if one of the appeals of the short story is that, I mean, everyone knows how long a novel is, but a short story is just as long as it takes.
It's as long as it takes, absolutely. Yeah, it is.
So I was wondering if that was part of the appeal, that you could just start going and let the voice take you where it needs to go, and then when it's done, it's done.
That's true. And I've been travelling an awful lot more in the last couple of years. So short stories are very good to write while you're on the move, because within a couple of days you can have generated a complete draft, which...
It's just a kind of practical consideration
exactly,
as well.
Exactly. And, you know, the sort of... The idea of disquieting the normal as well, which the short story does very well if you care to sort of go to that area. I have become more interested in this too. So sort of everyday occurrences that are somehow upended or... I suppose I've always been interested in these things in my writing, the dark tourism aspect, you know, people who are placed into a predicament and they have to respond to it in either a primal way or their intellectual capacity somehow fails them, or there's a conflict between the emotions and the intellect. So that's always been a consideration of mine. But the short story, I think, it's a very, very good form for exercising such things.
You say you've been travelling a lot, but these people, these women that we find them in different places in London, on holiday, in Africa, in York. Are these all places you're familiar with?
I've travelled to them. I'm not necessarily very familiar with them. But a couple of the stories in particular, you know, you find the characters aren't familiar with the territory either, and that creates part of the conflict and tension in the story. It might be a couple that are holidaying on a what seems to be an idyllic Finnish lake. And it is idyllic in a way. And then things start to go wrong. And again,
apart from the blood-filled lake, it's red.
Yeah, so there is a sense of foreboding. And that's interesting to me. Of course, I'm interested in landscape. I'm always asked about landscape, and it's very important to my work. And I like to create realistic settings and sensual settings. So these short stories have very sensual settings, but they're used in a way to disturb the normal, to kind of render people troubled or place them in jeopardy. So it's about not understanding the place that you arrive in. Mm. Your preconceptions might be entirely wrong about it. You're on a romantic holiday and things start to unravel. And again, when it comes to sort of survivalism, so the more extreme scenarios, Mozambique and Finland, where the landscape is actually very wild, there is this idea that it's not necessarily the first incident that happens to you that makes everything go wrong. It's how you respond to that. I think you hear people like Ray Mears talk about this all the time, don't you? It's not actually crashing the plane into the jungle. It's then what you do after that, whether you start wandering around in circles or whether you act sensibly. And often the characters are not necessarily acting sensibly. There's a psychological space in which these stories are operating to the main protagonist. You know, a lot of the terror is built up in the mind of a character, and then they start to respond to an imaginary scenario within the wilderness.
And so responding inappropriately, exactly, and getting into further scrapes. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I was wondering, because the landscapes are drawn so brilliantly, I'm wondering if on holiday, if you're making notes all the time.
No.
If you're taking photographs.
I'm on holiday when I'm on holiday. I'm lying in the lake, floating around.
But it's particular things that come back to you later,
yeah,
is it?
I'm not a great photographer either. So when I travel, I don't take photographs very often. And that really annoys my mum, because she always says, can you just please come back with some photographs to show me of the places you've been. But I do try and sort of study the place where I'm staying or visiting in a way where I will absorb some of the sort, again, the sensual qualities of it, the scent of the place, what the weather's like, geology of a place. So I'm not actually physically taking notes. I possibly should, but I don't.
Just storing it away.
Yes. And of course it becomes corrupted up in the brain, which is a good thing too for fiction.
For sure. These landscapes that these women, and they're all women, the landscapes they find themselves are full of menace. You say there's a kind of sense of danger there. Where does this danger come from?
Well, it's partly actually the landscape that they find themselves in. So the story set in Mozambique, she murdered mortal he. That's a very dangerous coastline with some very dangerous tides. And the couple that arrive there know that. They try and swim and they just can't. And it's terrifying. So they get out of the water. So there is a physical jeopardy already. But again, it is a sort of psychological trouble that the couple has imported to that area. And their drama plays out.
I'm just wondering why it is that in this particular collection, you've chosen to put these women in such danger. What's interesting about that for you as a writer?
Oh, you know, it's the same as pulling the wings off insects probably. I suppose I'm interested in that because I'm a kid from the Lake District and civilization has come to most of Britain, and that's fine. There was a sense when I was growing up that it didn't take much for things to become not uncivilized in that there was warfare going on, but a bad snow meant you were stuck without power for a week until they flew new pylons into the valley. And I have these vivid memories of that. And so I suppose there's a sense in my work that although we're sitting in a nice glass studio here having a nice chat, we can go out and buy lattes, you know, we've got the vote, everything seems to be set and carefully constructed and safe, it doesn't really take very much if you move away from the cities and into different territories for that all to be taken away from you. And that's a real challenge. You know, how you act in a survival situation is a great challenge, and it makes for great drama.
Along with the danger and the death, there's also quite a bit of sex as well. But there's not that much about reading. Even your author doesn't much like books.
I've got my priorities entirely wrong.
I was wondering, do you spend much time reading yourself? Is that how you feel about books yourself?
No, I don't.
Do you think books aren't the fit subject for literature then?
I think they're a great subject for literature, along with anything else that you're interested in writing about. So there are writers that have written brilliantly about writing.
But just not you in this case.
It's not that I'm not interested in it. I'm not a vociferous reader, I suppose. I've written about this. I had a problem as a kid. I read, and I read enough books to seem as if I was adept at English, which I was in a way. But reading was very uncomfortable for me. There was something I came across a word the other day that I've now forgotten in the dictionary, meaning, it begins with F, I think, meaning the feeling of insects crawling over your skin. Ah. And I used to get that. There is actually a word for that. God, I must remember. And I used to slightly get that feeling whenever I was handling a book or about to open a book and having to commit to a story.
Mm. It just that feeling of being trapped, as your author
trapped,
says.
Perhaps, yeah. Or just, yeah. And wanting to get out into the real world. And again, that could be a symptom of being brought up somewhere very remote, where what I wanted was sort of real company, not just fictitious company. And perhaps I was a fussy reader even then, because if I'm not convinced by a novel or a short story or any book, if I'm not convinced by the characters or the place, within a few pages that book is closed and given away.
Does this make for awkward conversations now you're a famous writer hanging out
with
all sorts
of... Well, I just say I haven't read anything. That's the easiest way. A blanket. No, I haven't read your work. All your work.
You'd much rather be producing yourself.
Yes.
There you go. But when you produce a collection of short, such a strong collection of stories like this, a great thing, does it kind of narc you that it's not going to be in contention for major prizes? That it's
what?
You know...
What do you mean there aren't short story prizes?
But I mean, like the Booker Prize, for example, famously rules out short stories. And again, readers in the UK seem very unwilling to kind of commit to buying short stories. But
yeah.
Does that bother you?
All that will, a multi-part question. But in terms of people buying short stories, I mean, this is a debate that needs to be opened out, because a lot of the readings I go to, where I'm reading, if I ask people to put their hand up if they've bought a collection of short stories within the last month, most hands go up. People are buying short stories. Whether or not they're buying short stories by contemporary writers or collected Chekhov short stories is another thing. And publishers blame bookshops blame readers for not buying the short stories. So who knows really where the problem lies?
Is it one of those things whereby we always feel we ought to like short stories and so we sort of say it, but
Possibly, or maybe the Americans are embarrassing us into thinking that we ought to like the short stories. And people do like short stories. And
yeah, because when they actually read them, they love them.
Yeah, they're fantastic. I'm quite a sketchy reader anyway, so I like the short stories because, as I would a collection of poetry, you can open it up, pick a title that sounds good and read a story that way. I read short stories out of sync, really. I don't read collections from beginning to end.
Sarah Hall there. So all of you, Sarah says that this is a debate that needs to be opened up. Ali, you've written short stories. You write them in between your novels, don't you?
I do one, then I do the other, and it's a shift of focus, and I'm glad I have it. The short story is the most exciting form to work with because it's the hardest and because it's the most distilled. But everything about the short story passes into all the other forms of prose because it's the perfect distillation. If we have that in everything, and we have good writing. Readers love short stories. I just don't get it. I was at a festival last week and I said, what do you want? Do you want me to read from this new novel or do you want a story? And they all went, a story,
something
like children.
Something to get
the whole of, something discreet. They're going to get a full experience rather than something which they'll go away with half and half. Readers always will love short stories.
But is that readers or listeners?
Well, listeners too, I think. Oh, don't talk to me about listeners. I can't bear that the BBC is, Radio 4 is losing so many of its short story slots, which it has done, which is another terrible loss to the day in Radio 4, where there was the moment where you could just drop out of news into the imagination and then come back to news with the imagination, which is the difference that the story makes.
I mean, sometimes you think about whether all forms of social media, e-readers are going to militate against longer forms. They're going to mean that who wants to sit and read an 800-page novel on an e-reader? Are artists and writers going to start writing and thinking in sound bites? But actually, if you look at it the other way, I think there's a brilliant kind of freeing yourself from sort of tedious discussions about form. And when you think about people endlessly going on and on about whether the Julian Barnes was a novella or was it a novel or was it a long short story, it's so tedious. It was a story. And I think that a sort of freeing up of the boundaries mean that people can tell stories in whatever format and we don't actually have to put a kind of label on them anymore.
And Julian Barnes did particularly single out his designer.
I mean, I wrote a piece for The Guardian a couple of years ago about the physical properties of a book and why buying a book that you can hold in your hand is such a beautiful thing. And the example I used was I found a first edition copy of Unlikely Stories by Alistair Gray, which included the original, is hardcover, beautifully designed. He always designs his jackets, the hardboard, everything. And it included the original erratum slip, which is an erratum slip that says, this slip has been inserted in error. And you're never gonna get that in an ebook. The best, most beautiful, perfect, brilliant object I think published this year was a picture book by John Klassen called I Want My Hat Back. And it is hilariously funny. It works for adults and for kids. It doesn't go how you think it's going to go. It's about a bear who's lost his hat, and then he discovers where it's gone, and the ending isn't what you think it is. It is probably the most perfect published object this year, I think.
Thank you very much. Well, that's all from us this week. I'd also point out that if you're interested in beautiful books, it's really worth having a look at our competition to design the new educational edition of Lord of the Flies, which our children's website is running in conjunction with Faber and Faber. We've got about 15 entries in so far. It closes in January and they're a fantastically high standard. So that's maybe where the future of beautiful books lies there. You can see all those entries by going to guardian.co.uk/children's books. Do have a look. And if you know of any budding book designers aged between 13 and 16, please encourage them to get involved. We gather there's a great future in book design. And talking of futures, Alex, would you talk us through what's coming up in the next week in The Guardian and The Observer?
Yes, The Observer Review is rounding up the best books of the year for children, and The Guardian Saturday Review has a piece by the writer Michelle Faber on a new book listing the 1001 comics you must read before you die.
Well, that's absolutely sure to be a beauty. Thank you very much to Alex Clark, Ali Smith, Patrick Ness, Richard Lee and Sarah Hall, not forgetting our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.